It's really good to see you. If you would take out your Bibles and turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings 18 will be our text for tonight. While you're doing that, I wanted to welcome all of you, but I also wanted to say a couple things about Jason Reynolds. I just love when Jason Reynolds gets up in front of us in any capacity and helps us focus on worship. I appreciate the songs that he picks and the way that he thinks about that and the way that he does the work that he does. I love that he says that he's going to call in his brother Rob. Jason's just such an infectious and contagious guy, and I appreciate that about him. But I appreciate tonight so much that he picked those songs. And I've sang those songs since I was a little kid. And they were some of my favorite songs, Ring Out the Message and all the fun evangelism songs. Do you think it's any coincidence that, like, the hardest thing in the world is evangelism, so the songs that we write about it are really fun? Because I wonder how many of us are going to do that this week? How many of us are going to really want to be a soul winner for Jesus? I assume this about this group, that everybody does want to do that. But how many of you are going to do that this week? I know you want to, but that song we just sang about ringing out the message, that's scary stuff to me. Speaking up when I need to speak up, telling people about God. There's a couple things to focus on, and I have to say, this group of Christians probably are some of the best I've ever seen at this. It's only going to happen if we do what that song we sang said. He's done so much for me. We got to know that. We've got to want to be a soul winner for Jesus because he's done that for me. And we got to know, like we just sang in that last song, that when we ring out the message, that what we're doing is we're telling people about things that will give them courage and will help them to be true. I liked that line. I had never thought about that. Any of you more courageous in your life because of what God's done for you? Any of you more true in your way and in your thoughts and in your behavior because you got to know the message of the Lord? And if we can get a hold of the idea that we love people enough and what God's done for us enough that we can talk about things that make people more courageous and more true, then I think we'll do a better job of that this week. And I appreciate Jason doing that. I think if we just focused on the message of those great songs that we just sang to each other, that would be a good night. But I want to tell you a Bible story. And it occurs to me, which I don't know that it had so much, this is really a story about evangelism. In a very different way, but I'll try to apply it to us. In 1 Kings chapter 18, there is a battle that takes place. Sometimes we call it the Carmel battle. The battle between Elijah and the prophets of Baal or Baal. I don't care so much how I say that word, so I suggest you not care so much how I say that word, whether it's Baal or Baal. I know. Just deal with it. So there's two groups fighting about something. And it's a great battle, and it's a great story, and many of you know it. Some of you may not know it very well. But to set the scene for this great battle, which starts around verse 20 in the chapter, let me give you the historic context of this. I suppose the history of this battle goes back long before this time, maybe even into the time of the conquest of Canaan. When the Israelites came out of Egypt and wandered in the wilderness and were taught by God who he was, and then we're told to go into the promised land and take it and to destroy the people and their gods. And they didn't do it. And Joshua gave a great speech at the end of his book where he stood before the Israelites and he said, "Choose you this day who you will serve." There's always a choice. And in this story, there's going to be a choice. And Elijah is going to be the messenger to present again to the people who they're going to choose. No, there's something else going on in this text that's a battle. It's not just the battle between God and Baal. It's the battle between God's throne and man's throne. Baal or Baal is an interesting Hebrew word. It doesn't just mean a god of some sort. Sometimes it means husband. Isn't that great? Or master or leader. A Baal or a Baal sort of carried with it the idea of somebody that was a leader. And so these people would turn to different Baals of different areas. There was a Baal of the flies. There was different kinds of gods that were these leaders or these masters. But in the context of Israel's history, here's kind of what's going on. God's supposed to be the master, the king, or the husband, but they're serving other gods. Some of those leaders that they served were actually kind of like their own kings. There is a conflict at this point in Israel's history between God's throne and Israel's throne. When the people ask for a king, they turn their back on God, in a sense, as king. And now you see through these chapters battles between God's spokesmen, who were not the kings. God's leaders weren't the guys sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. God's leaders were the prophets who spoke on his behalf, and there is conflict between these two. Just so you get that this is not just about God versus Baal, let me show you the immediate context. Look at chapter 18 and verse 16. So Obadiah, who was a prophet, went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. Actually, Obadiah was somebody who had kept prophets hidden, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But here, Ahab and Elijah are about to meet. Now look at this meeting in verse 17. When Ahab, who was the king, saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is this you, you troubler of Israel?" He said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals." Now, let's stop there just for a minute. This is an interesting, I think, dialogue. By the way, they've not seen each other for probably like 3.5 years. About 3.5 years before this event, Elijah had prayed a prayer and asked God to not let it rain on the earth. The end of the book of James in the New Testament tells us about that. We'll look at that in just a minute. But for about 3.5 years, they haven't seen each other. All Ahab knows is that Elijah had prayed that it didn't rain. And for the last 3.5 years, there's been nothing. So when Ahab sees Elijah, he says, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel? You're the guy that's the reason for this drought." And Elijah looks at him and says, "I'm not the troubler of Israel. You're the troubler of Israel." I have a question. Who's telling the truth here? Can I say, I think this is one of the most significant points in this whole lesson, so pay attention, because this is something people don't understand. It's something that sometimes I don't understand. Who's the troublemaker? The one that commits sin and does wrong and has to be told that God's way is a different way? Or is it the person that speaks up and says, "Hey, God says this"? In your workplace, who's the troublemaker? Is it you when you try to be evangelistic? Now, they'll tell you that. They'll tell you you're the troublemaker because you're not supposed to talk about God. Now, who's the troublemaker? Is it the preacher that gets up and says, "This is right and this is wrong. This is a perversion. This is the truth"? And a lot of people will look at guys like that and say, "That guy's a troublemaker." Who's the troublemaker? Was Jesus Christ a troublemaker? Jesus said that he came to bring a sword, and I'll tell you what, in that little plot of land over there in Palestine, he caused a lot of trouble, didn't he? Was Jesus the real troublemaker? Or were the Pharisees and false religion and false ideas about who the Father in heaven was, were they the real troublemakers? You get the point, don't you? It's very important that we understand that if I speak the Lord's things and I do it in love and I do it for the good of humanity and I do it for those that I want to save, that no matter what somebody says about me being a troublemaker, it's not really me. It's causing the trouble. It's sin. It's deception. And it's those that buy into it and think that it's okay to live that way. And that's part of what we learn here. Let me show you the sins of Ahab. Go back to chapter 16 for just a moment. 16:29. Now Ahab the son of Omri became king of Israel in the 38th year of Asa king of Judah. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. It came about, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. So he erected an altar of Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. In his days, Hiel the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. Now, there's a number of things that are said there about Elijah, or excuse me, about Ahab, and how he intermarried with the king of the Sidonians, and he did a bunch of things wrong, and he built a house to Baal. But now let me show you what Elijah said in chapter 17, verse 1. Now, Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the settlers of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, surely there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." And then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Go away from here." Let me ask you one more question. In that exchange between Ahab and Elijah, who's the troubler of Israel? Can you think of a deeper answer to that, besides it being Elijah and Ahab? Who's really the one that caused it not to rain? It's God. You know what I learned from this? Is that sometimes God causes trouble. Sometimes God does things in the world that maybe we don't fully understand. That there's a time of drought for a nation or a land or a region. There's a time of drought for an individual or a family. There's a time of need and we wonder at it. And it could be that maybe somebody has sinned and God wants to get their attention, as in the case of Ahab. Or it may be that somebody somewhere prayed for some reason and we don't know all the reasons. But what I do know is that God is a God of love. And he knew that Ahab's sin was not good for Israel. And he knew that disciplining both Ahab and Israel to get their attention was what needed to be done. Because whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. And just because we may be on the side of the Lord and have to sometimes say that God tries to get our attention, and we try not to explain away everything that God does when somebody's hurting, but to encourage people to remember that God needs to be thought of and served. Let's go to the battle in chapter 18. Chapter 18, verse 20. Let's actually start. I want to show you a couple things here in verse 19. It says, "Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table." So there's this huge gathering. All of Israel comes to Mount Carmel. If I remember right, when I was in Israel, Mount Carmel is not a terribly tall mountain. It's fairly small and not that big. It's more sort of like a hill. And I could see, at least from where I was when we drove past it, that it looked like people could gather around and perhaps see what was going on the place. I would say that you might ask other people that went with me to Israel if they remember if that's what it looked like, but they were all asleep when we went by the mountain. And I tried to wake them all up, and some of them were your daughters. And they said, "That's great," and went back to sleep. So here in verse 20, it says that Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people did not answer him a word. Can I have you look at that verse again regarding evangelism? Is that an appropriate question to ask people? You know, I don't know what Elijah's tone was. I don't know if he was hard on them and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" with anger. Maybe he asked it more contemplatively. Maybe he asked it more softly. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If God's God, serve him. If Baal's God, serve him. But what's this going back and forth? And by the way, you have friends and family like this. They kind of go back and forth. They talk about maybe serving God. They talk about maybe serving the world. They kind of go between the two. And I think a question like this is wholly appropriate. But let me point out something else from the verse. Nearly every time you ask somebody this question, it's going to be the same. People don't like to answer the question. So they kept silent, as most people you ask will keep silent about it. Until they're convinced that there's some reason that they should serve one over the other. So let's see how these folks are convinced. Verse 22. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. So if he was to ask the question then, who should you serve? We're living in a community where there's 450 churches, prophets, preachers, teachers who are saying that this is the way that it's to be done. Yet, there's just one of me. Who are you going to choose now? Is it a popularity contest? Does that make something right? Verse 23. "Now let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people said, "That is a good idea." That is a good idea. Isn't it? Come on, let's be fair. Haven't you ever wished you could just do that? With the people that you talk to about God and different religions and different churches and all that stuff, don't you wish that you could just say, "All right, here we go. Come here. We're going to have a contest. I'm going to build a stack of wood. You're going to build a stack of wood. And we're going to say a prayer. And whichever stack of wood lights up, then that's the one that's right." Anybody else wish they could do that? Anybody else be nervous about that little contest? By the way, I'm not suggesting you ever do that for evangelism's sake. But sometimes you have people sort of say, "Well, why don't you do something like that? Prove it to me." Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Look at verse 25. "So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, 'Choose one ox for yourself and prepare it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it.' Then they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, 'O Baal, answer us.' But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they made. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, "Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened." So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. Can you imagine that scene? They cut up an ox, they put it on the wood, and they say, from morning until noon, "Obeil, answer us, Obeil, answer us, Obeil, answer us, Obeil, answer us." Tell me when you get tired of this. "Obeil, answer us, from morning until noon." And everybody's standing around watching. Pretty soon, that gets old and nothing's happening, and Elijah begins to tease them and say, "Well, maybe he's on a journey. Maybe he's gone to sleep. Maybe he's gone off the path. Go look up what that means. And go see if you can wake him up since he's a god." Nothing happens. So these guys start cutting themselves with swords and stones and lances and bleeding, thinking that maybe their god will have pity on them if he sees them suffering, and there's no answer. Thank God that God's not like that. Verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." So all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. I want you to picture this, please. These guys have been making a scene all day long, and now Elijah says, "Come close to me." And he walks over to an altar that used to be to Jehovah that had not been used and had been broken down. The kids of the neighborhood perhaps had played on it and taken the stones away. Who knows? But he begins to build the altar. Imagine that being quiet. Stone by stone, this man picks up a stone, puts it on. How many stones does he take? 12. I wonder if he named the sons, named the tribes, to remind everybody of their heritage and their God and where they'd come from. But they've got to watch it all. They've got to watch the 12 stones. They've got to watch him build it. They've got to watch him dig the trench. What must they have been feeling all that time? And then after he puts the sacrifice, or he builds the altar, he arranged the ox on the altar. And he says, "Pour water on it." By the way, do you remember what it hasn't done in 3.5 years? Hadn't rained. Do you suppose that everybody's just like, "Oh yeah, we got plenty of that"? There's not much of that. And by the way, this is a great time to have a sacrifice contest, because if somebody just thrown a rock hard enough, then it might have lit the wood. It's dry as can be here. And he pours water on this thing 3 times. Fills the trench up with water. It's impossible. Even if he tried to light it himself, it's impossible. Verse 36. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord. Answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Then Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. What do you suppose it was like to see that? Elijah says a prayer. I want you to notice something in it in just a moment that he says. But he says a prayer, and then the fire falls, and it just licks everything up, including the water. And the people all begin to say, "Yahweh is Elohim. Jehovah is God." When was the last time people were saying that? What must that have done for Elijah? He's so empowered by that he says, "Grab the false prophets," and they grab them, and they are killed. You ever known anybody that finally learned truth or was reminded of what was right? The kind of frustration that came out at the people that taught them wrong. If you can understand that a little bit, you might be able to understand this. There are a whole bunch of stories, or a whole bunch of lessons that can be learned from this. But I'm going to keep it very simple. The lesson that I learned from this story is there's always two choices. Always. In the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, it's Jesus or the old law. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 20, Jesus said that we can never either set our hearts on heaven or on earth. That we can either sin and do wrong and be a slave to it in Romans 6, or we can do right and be a slave to righteousness by being baptized into Christ. There's always two choices. And that question that Elijah asked at the beginning of this, how long are you going to hesitate between the two choices? It's an important question, but here's the point. What should we choose? God's in the business of providing evidence that what should be chosen are the things that show the results, the power, the thing that merits the choice. But if you do this thing, this is the result. God's in the business of showing that He can do something about the problem at hand. So how does that apply to you and me? You know, we're not going to ever get to have a contest like this, I don't think. And by the way, don't ever take it on yourself to have a contest like this. Like God, like as if God's going to just think that our contest is a great contest. Did you notice verse 36? Look at it again real close. Look at the last thing that he says in verse 36. "I have done all these things at your word." This was God's idea. This wasn't Elijah's thought, "Let's just do this and hope that God does it." God told him to do it. So unless God tells you this is the contest, then don't go trying to do it. Because I have another thought about what the contest really is. I think God's already put it in place. I think God's already told us in our family, in our workplace, in our community, how He's going to show the improbable, the impossible, the thing that merits choosing right. I think He's already laid it out and told us to choose. But it's not exactly like this. It's more like during your drought. When things aren't going right. Whether it's a time of trial or whether it's just the day that you're having in the workplace environment that's coming over, is taking over everybody else, and things are so depleted that you just want to not be a sacrifice. You just want to not trust God. You just want to not stand out in some way. But all of a sudden, the Christian does different. And it doesn't matter if Satan's poured buckets of water on you. You are still ignited by the Lord. And people wonder about that. I think God does this all the time. I don't think Mount Carmel was the only mountain that God ever did this on. I think everybody that's sitting here today has seen it at some point in their life when they were hesitating between two opinions, that they watched the thing become a sacrifice by the power of God, even though everything was against it, all of it was given up to the Lord, and it was you. It was somebody that you saw. And people begin to say, God is Lord. I think it's a great story. I'd like to tell you more about it, but I'm out of time. So I'll let that be what it is. And I'll encourage all of us to think more like Elijah. I have a personal opinion about Elijah that not everybody shares. I think Elijah was very afraid a lot. Right after this story, he runs away. And when he gets to the mountain where he runs, God asks him what he's doing there. And he says, I'm the only one left. And God corrects him and says, that's not true. You know what? I think Elijah was mistaken at the beginning of the battle when he said, I'm the only prophet of the Lord. If you look like five verses before that, Obadiah said there were like 100 hidden in a cave. Sometimes we get the idea that we're the only ones. We're wrong about that. But that kind of arrogance or whatever comes out in fear sometimes. And sometimes it comes out in judgment. And sometimes it comes out in ways that it shouldn't. But you know what I'm most excited about living in Minnesota about? Is I keep finding out there's a whole bunch of people that haven't bowed their knees to Baal. I'm meeting them all the time. Some of them are now sitting among us. And we as a church and we as individuals ought never to think that there's not people of the Lord somewhere that just need to see the demonstration. Thanks for paying attention today. If we can help you at all, we sure would like to. If you'd like to become a Christian, you know that Jesus is the Son of God and you're willing to confess that. But you haven't done it. And you haven't submitted to His command to be baptized for the remission of your sins. We would love to help you with that. If you need to repent of sin or need our prayers, whatever it is we can do for you, now's the time by coming forward while we stand and sing.